You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, your name could say a lot about you. It might carry your reputation, your identity as an individual. You might be named after someone and feel that deeper connection to them. Your last name might say something about your family, maybe where your ancestors came from. Or you might change your name legally or informally in daily use to better reflect who you see yourself as, the perception you want to give off. Historically, name changes were often a way to avoid discrimination, but over time, people's motivations for changing their names have also shifted. Our next guest has spent more than a decade researching name changes and ethnic identity to understand what our names say about us and why we might change them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you changed your name for one reason or another, first and or last, legally or just, you know, what people call you in person? Why did you want to change it? And do you know the story of your family's last name? Was it changed maybe in the early days of immigration? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kirsten Vermeiglisch is a professor of history and Jewish studies at Michigan State University, where she researches the historical meanings and nature of ethnic identity. She's the author of several books. Her most recent is called A Rosenberg by Any Other Name, A History of Jewish Name Changing in America. Kirsten, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate your inviting me to be on this.
Now, you did some fascinating research for that book I mentioned. You look back now in New York, where so many immigrants started their experience in the United States, going back, looking over name-changing petitions in the U.S. for decades and decades. What inspired you to dig into those?
Oh, well, I usually say to people as a joke that when you have a name like Kirsten Vermeiglisch, of course you're going to be interested in name changing.
The ferrets of the world, by the way, but I stuck with it.
And we actually have family members who've changed their names even more, and there's a whole firm part of my family. I never changed my name. The name did used to be something long, slightly different, but it wasn't really. I mean, that played a role in it. I think I've always found names fascinating, but I'm also a scholar of American Jewish history and American history. And I have always been really interested in sort of the ways that people kind of use names to try to identify, particularly who's Jewish, you know, sort of ideas about sort of what a Jewish name is. And so I just thought it would be a really interesting place to go to kind of think about how people have defined their ethnic community and thought about who is and who's not in the community.
I have this notion in my head that there are so many people who came from Eastern Europe or Italy or you name it, and they hit Ellis Island, and that Ellis Island clerk simplified or Americanized their names. And according to your research, I guess not so much.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so my research, I usually sort of say that genealogists and anybody who's really looked at Ellis Island kind of knows that this isn't the case, that it certainly was not a wide scale phenomenon. There's no evidence of it. If you look, sometimes, I mean, it's hard to do this on the radio. I sometimes will do this visually. If you look at manifests, which people listening to the show might have done genealogy, and they might have looked at the ship manifest where their ancestors came in. And if you look closely at those, you'll see little check marks. People at Ellis Island, the officials at Ellis Island actually didn't take record. They didn't actually write down anybody's name. They actually checked your name against your ship manifest. And there were actually rules at Ellis Island saying you could not change a name. And in fact, American law, all the states in the United States are actually very flexible in their naming, in the ability to change your name. So even if an Ellis Island official did change your name, you could just change it back really easily and quickly and unofficially. So usually, I and other scholars kind of want to emphasize that probably your name was not changed at Ellis Island, even though I know that's really disappointing and upsetting for people who've heard that story from families. And instead, what I found in my research is actually, if you look at name change petitions, so many people actually chose to change their names.
Let's talk about that. And in your research, you found that recent Jewish immigrants, or maybe even not so recent, changed their names, not just because they wanted to sound more American, but for very specific reasons. Discrimination. What did you find?
Yeah, I mean, I was really, when I went into my research, I really didn't know what to find. Really, nobody else has done this research before me. There's very little research into name changing. So I really really didn't know what to expect. And I was really, really surprised to see, I mean, my first experience in walking into the archive the first day, I walked actually into the courthouse and they just showed me into this little tiny room that just had wall-to-wall boxes of name change petitions. And like huge numbers of them were all 1930s and 1940s, especially, just boxes and boxes. So not during an era of major immigration. And instead, sort of the largest numbers came in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, after immigration had actually slowed to a trickle. And so what was really interesting to see, so that was one thing that really surprised me. And the other thing that I hadn't really expected was how many Jewish surnames were being changed. Predominantly surnames, some first names too, but predominantly surnames. And it really matches up with the institution and sort of the spiraling of institutionalized anti-Semitism in the United States, which really rose in the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s. And so I think it's really significant that all these Jews are changing their names at this time when they pay a penalty for having Jewish surnames or Jewish names at all. People sort of identify them and then won't give them jobs, won't let them into schools. And so I think that that was really significant that at that time, as people are experiencing this kind of discrimination, they're choosing to erase these names that kind of made them targets.
Talking to historian Kirsten Vermeiglisch from Michigan State University, looking at the history of name changes in the United States, why we change our names and how that changes over history. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a story maybe about the evolution of a name in your family, an official name change, or how the pronunciation maybe changed over the years? Have you changed your name for some reason? What led to that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kirsten, I imagine this must be an ambivalent moment for a lot of people historically. They would like to not be discriminated against. They'd like to get that job. So there's that incentive to change a name, but they might feel like, hey, what about this connection with, you know, my family and all of its history?
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I mean, you know, what I wound up finding was a lot of both about sort of family history, but also about how people felt in the moment, their communities, right? So what I think a lot of people hadn't really looked at before, and what I think that I was able to find in my research was that certainly in the Jewish community, there was a lot of ambivalence and actually kind of anger and frustration with Jewish name changers, especially after World War II, you know, after the Holocaust. There was a great deal of kind of frustration and anger even directed at people who had changed their names. So people who changed their names reported being made fun of by members of their community. I found a petition of a man who had changed his name, and when he wanted to get married, the family he was marrying into made him change his name back. They refused to allow their daughter to get married to the changed name. So there was a lot of, and there were a lot of movies and books and other kinds of cultural artifacts that, you know, sort of made fun of name changers or kind of made them the villains in the stories. I think there was a lot of and a lot of kind of family disquiet. You know, I interviewed a few people who talked about sort of anger and frustration or just, you know, unhappiness that they had this name that had been changed and they hadn't known about it, you know, family secrets and things like that. So, yeah, I think that it led to, I think, some disruption and really sort of pointed to some fissures within the Jewish community as people had different responses to anti-Semitism. They had different responses to sort of how to deal with the discrimination they were facing.
In that time period, did you see other communities seeing similar waves of name changes? I think in pop culture of the Untouchables movie where a Giuseppe Petri becomes George Stone, was this happening with non-Jewish groups in New York?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And as I say, when I started doing the project, I actually thought I was going to see people of all groups changing their names. Maybe I didn't say that, but I should have. I didn't know what to expect. And I didn't necessarily think that it was going to be overwhelmingly Jews. And I most certainly did see Italians and Poles. I mean, it's New York, so it was inflected by the groups that are there. So a lot of Italians and Greeks, smaller numbers of people with Polish surnames. But I absolutely did see those. you know, one reason certainly there were many more Jews than there were those groups. And I think one reason for that is probably the kinds of jobs that Jews were looking for in comparison to other ethnic groups. Jews at that time, the 1920s and the 1930s, were predominantly looking for white or pink collar jobs. So clerks, women were looking for jobs as secretaries. And for a lot of other ethnic groups, Italians and Greeks, they might not have been looking for those kinds of jobs. Women would frequently stay outside of the paid workforce. Men were frequently looking for more working class jobs, maybe longshoremen jobs, union jobs. And those were jobs that at that time, you didn't need to fill out an application form. It's kind of weird to think about at this moment, but like the filling out of an application form and the way that your name might attract attention was really significant at this time in history. So Italians who might have changed their names, Poles who might have changed their names, they might not have felt that they needed to do so kind of legally and formally using these name change petitions. If they were looking for working class jobs, they might have gone to like another union member, right? And been like, you know, can you find me a job at the factory? Or they might have found a job by standing on a street corner, right? And, you know, sort of getting a job. Domestic servants might have found a job that way. So Jews, both because they're experiencing more discrimination and also because they're looking for white collar work where they have to put their names down on a form in a way that other groups aren't. So I absolutely see, and this is not to say that I think other groups were absolutely changing their names, but maybe not in so many numbers because they're not facing the same kinds of, you know, this rise of anti-Semitism, but also because they're looking for different kinds of jobs. And so they show up in the economy in different ways and their names aren't necessarily attracting the same kinds of negative attention that Jews are at that time.
Let's bring on a caller. Kristen is with us in Middleton. Kristen, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I'm trying to mess with the phone here. I grew up outside of Detroit, and my father had always told me, oh, we go way back in the history of Detroit, back to the 1700s, but our name was not always Hall. It was some French name. And as I got into genealogy, I kept, it's my brick wall. I didn't know where to go with that. And with the help of some angels and some help, I finally found out what our French name was. And in Canada, the name was Michel Batry. But when they would cross the border, across the river into Detroit, because of the discrimination, they would use their stepfather's name. Back in 1803, the Batry wife married a man named Benjamin Hall. Uh-huh. So when they crossed to Detroit, they became Hall. They go back to the Windsor area and they were Batry. So back and forth with baptismal papers over there was Batry.
Wow. But Kristen, thanks a lot for sharing that. And I'm glad you solved that mystery. Kirsten, I don't know if you have a lot of Quebecois people showing up to your records in New York, but that kind of back home, we're still old name over here. We are new name, I guess, probably didn't just happen in Detroit.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a super fascinating story. Thank you so much for calling in. And it really does sort of show, I think, the significance of discrimination. I think so much of name changing, people sort of generally say, oh, people wanted to Americanize. But I think really thinking about the impact of discrimination on groups and the reasons, very practical reasons that people want to change names, I think that's a super important part of that story. And I think also another important part of that story is, yeah, wanting to keep connections to family. Right? People don't necessarily always want to just be remaking themselves and erasing their older family connections. They want to maintain those connections a lot of times. And so name changes is sometimes something that people see as very practical. And yeah, I mean, definitely I found stories in New York of people who might have come and found, say, that their family members are using a different name, right? Their families have taken on a different different name, and maybe they're living with that family, or their family has convinced them that this is, you know, a good name to take on in the United States, or they may themselves be experiencing discrimination, or they may feel that sort of to, you know, sort of present a level of kind of middle class respectability, right? If everybody in the family has that name, that it might be embarrassing for one last person not to have changed their name. So I think that there was some pressure there for people to take on the name that you know, other people had already taken on. So I think all of those kinds of factors play a role. I'm really so glad that you were able to find that too. I certainly talked to a lot of people who do genealogy and they can't figure out where it came from. Oh, that's wonderful that you were able to find that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kristen. We're talking to Michigan State University History and Jewish Studies Professor Kirsten Vermeiglich about why we change our names, how our names shape our identities, historical trends in why and when people change their names. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did your name change in your family's history, your last name? Have you changed your name? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Kirsten Vermeiglich. She researches ethnic identity as a professor of history at Michigan State University. She's with us today talking about the role our names play in our identities and why people change their names and why those reasons have changed over time. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kirsten, the reason people have changed their names has changed over time. You followed other ethnic groups at different points in history. What kind of things have stood out to you?
Well, so, you know, much of the work, I mean, certainly and guided by what I saw in the archive, there was definitely this sort of phenomenon of Jews changing their names, say from like 1917 through the 1960s. And then Jews kind of fell out of the petitions, I think, as institutionalized anti-Semitism dropped out of the workforce. I think fewer people felt that they needed to change their names. But by the 21st century, the name changes remained pretty low. But then by 2001, and the years after 9/11, I saw a huge upsurge in name changing. The population of New York City changed. Far more people of color, people of Asian background, Latino, Black, Middle Eastern, North African peoples all moved into the city. And so by the years after 2001, by the 21st century, I really saw sort of an intense flourishing of name changing from all those different groups. Some of the ones that seemed sort of interesting to me were ones, I mean, there was no one group that kind of dominated, but there were a good number of Asian Americans changing their names in ways that were in some ways similar and some ways different from what happened earlier in the 20th century. And then also the case of Muslim Americans was also in some ways similar to what happened to Jews earlier, and then in some ways really, really different and really fascinating that sort of talks differently about what discrimination looks like today for different ethnic groups and people of color.
Did that post 9/11 wave continue for a long time, or was it a brief flare up of people with, Muslim sounding names changing their name just last for a couple years?
Yeah, no, I initially stopped my research I thought I would just stop with the 20th century. And then people said to me, you should really go look and see what happened after 9/11 to people with Muslim sounding and North African sounding names. And so I did. And I was really struck to see that in the years right after 9/11, that, you know, there was an upsurge in name changing among people who had names that sounded Muslim, people with names like Muhammad, people who had names like Osama, people with those kinds of names were changing their names in similar numbers, with a lot of the reasoning that sounded sometimes more explicit than what Jews had said earlier in the century. And sometimes that sounded exactly like what had happened earlier in the century. People worrying about not getting jobs, people worrying about not being able to get into school, people worried about sort of suspicion or anger or being embarrassed in front of, other people. I mean, really, sometimes really heartbreaking kinds of petitions. What I found striking was that the petitions did not stay as much of an upsurge. So by 2012, 11 years after 2001, I didn't see disproportionate numbers of people with Middle Eastern or North African names changing their names.
I want to bring on one more quick call before we run out of time. Sharon is with us in La Crosse. Sharon, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up a couple points about first names being very feminine or very masculine, and that people that are transgender, changing their names, and sometimes that name change can be public. It can be a public notice, or you can have a judge that'll help you change it privately.
I gotcha, Sharon. We just have a few moments left, Kirsten, but that seems like it'd be an interesting field for future research, people who are changing gender identity and legally changing their names.
Yeah, actually, I'm just going to be publishing an article about that, actually. I think that's a fantastic point, and I'm so glad you brought it up. In addition to sort of seeing more Muslim names or more Asian American names, I actually found large numbers of people who are transgender changing their names. And New York City, actually, in terms of talking about doing it privately instead of publicly, New York City began to waive. You used to have to do it publicly, but New York City began waiving it because so many people who are transgender were afraid for their safety. And so now you can do that more privately. That is a really important contemporary trend in name changing. I'm so glad you brought that up.
Thanks for that call, Sharon. And Kirsten, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this. Have a wonderful day.
You too. That's Kirsten Vermeiglich, professor of history and Jewish studies at Michigan State University, author of the book A Rosenberg by Any Other Name, A History of Jewish Name Changing in America. She's with us today to talk about name changing, how trends in why people change their names have changed over time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, growing up in the Midwest, I remember learning the history of the region something like this. There were Native Americans here before European settlers came, but then American and European immigrants came in the 1800s and settled a mostly empty, unpopulated wilderness. If you look at maps of the history of the region, you can see Wisconsin as a French possession, then a British territory, then part of the newly created United States, even though the indigenous population was larger than the European population until well into the 1800s. Our next guest says there's a huge story hidden by commonly held views of history, of efforts to expand the boundaries of American statehood by taking land from Native Americans, and of resistance to those efforts by the indigenous people of Wisconsin and the wider Midwest. In his new book, he tells the story of treaties made and violated, land stolen and sold, and the Native leaders, U.S. government officials, and others in the middle of the story. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about indigenous tribes and the colonization of Wisconsin? What do you remember learning about that period in history? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Michael Witkin is a professor in the Department of History and the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race at Columbia University. He's a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. His latest book is called Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. It was named a Pulitzer Prize finalist this year. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about this effort that's at the heart, I think, of your book, correcting this gap that I certainly grew up with in my understanding of the history of our region?
Yeah, I think the way you phrased it here at the beginning, that thinking about the history of Wisconsin, or at least the non-Native history, as a colonial history, as a history of this colonization of Wisconsin, I think that's kind of new to most people. And I think that's one of the things that I wanted to recover, that this wasn't a state or a continent that was sort of empty and settled by pioneers who tamed a wilderness, but rather it was an indigenous continent, and its settlement by non-Native people was an act of colonization.
The idea from even before the United States became a country that was at the heart of this seems to be, okay, we English, the English settlers, we define use of land in this way. A person holds title to this piece of land and improves it. And Native Americans aren't doing that, not in the way we'd expect. That, therefore, that gives us, the English, and then the Americans, the right to take that land. That seems to be at the heart of so much of westward expansion, including here in what was the Northwest Territory.
Absolutely. I mean, so this is the sort of idea of discovery, or sometimes called the doctrine of discovery. And this is the idea that when Europeans arrive in the Americas, and in North America in particular, that they found a new world, and that that new world was, for all intents and purposes, uninhabited because it didn't have sort of recognizable forms of property or private property like you would have in Western Europe. And with that as a sort of framework, the original colonial project allowed monarchs from Europe to say, I've discovered this land, it's unsettled, and therefore I can claim it by right of discovery. The right of discovery becomes a way in which they grant crown charters to colonies in the Eastern Seaboard. There's the Seven Years' War where the revolution, or Seven Years' War where the two competing empires, France and Great Britain, compete with one another. France loses, they cede their claims to North America to the British. And following the revolution, at the settlement of that war, the British Empire cedes huge swaths of North America to the United States, all through this idea about a right of discovery, that they were essentially passing land that had been claimed because it was unsettled by kings, claimed as a possession, incorporated into empire, and then transferred to the Republic. And so the Republic basically takes up that same ideological project, the idea that the territory in the west of the Appalachian Mountains that had been granted to it by the Treaty of Paris that ends the Revolution is unsettled land, and the U.S. sets out to kind of settle that. And the story of Wisconsin is totally wrapped up in that process, the settlement where the United States has to come to grips with the fact that the land is not empty, that it's occupied by Native people, and that settling isn't just a matter of moving settlers onto a forest and changing it, but rather engaging with Native people and then actively sort of working to colonize them and their land.
We operated under this Northwest Ordinance here in the Northwest Territory that included Wisconsin. Can you talk about what that was and how it set the stage for how that land would be taken and then distributed?
Sure. So the Northwest Ordinance is the way by which the United States figures out what to do with it. When we come out of the Revolution, all this land, really from the Appalachian Mountains out to the Mississippi, the United States regards as part of its public domain. That is, it's the land that I mentioned had been transferred by the Great Britain to the United States. It's not settled by Americans. Therefore, they consider it public land that's controlled by the federal government. And they decide the way to settle that orderly with the Northwest Ordinance, which is a land law. And the ordinance is a way that you can both organize territory, and that will eventually become a state, and then also sell the land within that territory. And the way the Northwest Ordinance works is that when you get 5,000 free white men, that's enough to organize a space as a territory, so the territory of Michigan or the territory of Indiana. Once the territory is organized, the progression goes from 5,000 free white men to 60,000 free white settlers. When you've reached the 60,000 population mark, the territory can petition the federal government to enter the Union as a state with its own constitution, and then it enters the Union as a state with all the rights and privileges that other states. And so that's the model that's used in order to create territories, turn the Northwest Territory into specific territories, the states that are now Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, and parts of Minnesota were all part of the original Northwest Territory. And for the most part, in the southern tier of the Northwest Territories, Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, they fill up really fast, and they reach the requisite population of 60,000 persons to become states and enter the Union all within the early 1800s. Ohio is a state in 1803. Illinois and Indiana, I think, are 1808 and 1818, respectively, have become states in the Union. And it's in part because those territories are all connected to the Ohio River, to the Mississippi, and the Mississippi connects that territory to the sort of larger market economy of the U.S., New Orleans, St. Louis. And so it makes sense if you want to be a farmer in Ohio or in Illinois, you can get your product to a market than a U.S. market. But above the Ohio River, what would now be, say, Michigan and Ohio territory, it makes a lot less sense to settle. And so those territories actually remain territories for a long time. Michigan Territory, which is formed in 1805, actually stays a territory, doesn't get the 60,000 population threshold until 1837. And Wisconsin isn't even organized as a territory until 1837. Before that time, it's part of Michigan. And as late as 1820, the Michigan territory, which would have been Michigan now, plus Wisconsin, plus Minnesota, had less than 20,000 non-native settlers. And that's, you know, going into 1820. So that's really late. It's not till the Erie Canal is completed and opens in 1826 that it begins to make sense to start moving into these more northern parts of the Northwest Territory, because only then can you start getting things like agricultural products or timber out to a market in the U.S.
Talking to Michael Witkin about his book, Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. You can join in if you have questions at 800-642-1234. Michael, a huge part of the story you tell is of how natives in Wisconsin and beyond reacted to this drive to populate the states with settlers from out east. What were some of the key points in the story you researched?
There's several key points. There's an important treaty in 1837 that cedes a huge swath of Wisconsin, now is Wisconsin, I think something around the nature of 11 million acres. And it's a treaty that the indigenous peoples tell American officials they don't want to cede. And there's not a lot of population pressure in 1837 for that northern Wisconsin territory. But the U.S. basically tells the native people that they have to cede it or it'll be taken from them. And so they do. And that they are compensated something about, I think, in the nature of around 13 cents per acre, which the U.S. can then turn around and sell to the Northwest Ordinance for $1 an acre, so making an enormous amount of profit. And then that property often enters into circulation in private becomes private property of individuals who sit on it and don't necessarily develop it right away, and maybe sit on it for 10 or 15 years where it can sell for, say, $80 an acre. So you have this sort of massive transfer of land and wealth from native people to the federal government. And then the transfer of that federal government, that land as a public domain to the individual settlers in the United States, basically a subsidized way of settling the settlement, because you can sell that land at a way below market rate because the government has a monopoly when they acquire it from Native people. So it's a process where you're sort of facilitating the colonization by creating a sort of a monopoly on land sales and then making that land available in a really affordable manner to most people in order to encourage immigration.
And that's at the heart of the idea of plunder you introduce, actually even in the subtitle of your book. Can you talk about the scope of financial benefit to the United States, individuals, and to the federal government of that sort of forced appropriation of land and then distribution of it?
This was one of the things that really was a surprise for me. And if you think about the United States and the histories we all get in elementary school and junior high school and high school, these standard kind of survey histories, when you get to the early Republic, where you tend to find Indians in that history in a standard survey is with the Trail of Tears, the really tragic removal of Native peoples from what would then be the Southeast. You know, you can think of places like Georgia, North Carolina, the Alabama, Mississippi, the Trail of Tears. That's pretty common. And that makes sense with the story. There's a hunger for land. Indians are facing pressure. They're removed. You don't have that in the Northwest Territories. I mean, to some extent, Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, as I said, fill up really quick. But the land in territories like Michigan and Wisconsin, there's just less demand for it. And because there's less demand for it, the federal government sort of needs to entice people to move in. And what ends up happening is rather than having a pressure to remove Indians, people in states like Michigan and Wisconsin quickly discover that having Indians in place as sort of colonized subject is way more lucrative than kicking them off and taking over their land. And I say it's more lucrative because the treaty process, this treaty process where federal representatives of the federal government come in, negotiate with tribal members, often through people that are traders or Indian agents. And most of the traders and Indian agents are intermarried with the tribe, so they have indigenous wives and children. And they negotiate these treaties to cede land in exchange for a payment of money. Well, I mentioned that before with the 1837 treaty. So you get a $20,000 cash payment for 10 years for the sale of this 13 million acres. But when that payment is made, and the federal officials would show up with specie, with actual currency, which is often rare in early 19th century America, that payout usually went something in the neighborhood of 90% or more to traders or merchants who would claim that Native peoples owed them debt. from the fur trade, and debt that hadn't been repaid. And so each of these payments that were coming in to compensate Native people for the sale of land by a forced treaty, the money for that would mostly not end up in Native hands. It would mostly end up in the hands of merchants, traders, agents, people who were engaged in this fur trade. They would take that money and invest in their business, develop it in that way. The same merchants who were claiming that that money is debt would also be hired out by the government. Part of the payment was a cash payment in compensation for the land cession, but part of it was, say, $10,000 in provisions and goods. The federal government would buy those from the same merchants who were claiming it as debt. So they're making money by claiming the cash as debt. They're making money by covering the provisions that are also part of the annual payment for land sales by providing that to the federal government. So basically, you've got the sort of the leaders of the Wisconsin Territory, the Michigan Territory, often people who are connected with the fur trade, that history, helping it transition out of the fur trade and out of the Indian era by facilitating these land transfers, which bring tons of cash into the state or territory, cash that they then themselves can claim. So there's a lot of money to be made in not removing the Indians like you do in, say, Georgia or Alabama, but keeping them in place and negotiating treaty after treaty, which brings cash in, which you can then claim. So that cash becomes a way in which people basically develop the infrastructure of their businesses and the state economy. And it's a way of basically not just taking land, but really taking the wealth and land together, kind of plundering the resources of the indigenous population in order to sort of economically develop the state and territory.
Talking to Columbia University History Professor Michael Witkin about the book Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. In his work, he focuses a lot on Wisconsin and the surrounding region. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about his research and Native history in Wisconsin, the history of U.S. settlement in the region? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Michael Witkin about his book, Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. Let's go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi. Jeff, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff. Yep, go for it.
Well, this is living history, and it's very exciting to share with you that last year in 2022, we transferred land from the city of Superior, the Diocese of Superior, and the Douglas County back to the Fond du Lac tribe. First time they've owned land in Wisconsin, I think, since the Treaty of 1857. So under the right leadership, you can right some wrongs from the past, and it's an exciting time to remember that, 170 years later or something.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Michael, you are definitely thinking about this history you write about in the present day. What kind of things are you watching for with current land issues related to the descendants of the people you write about?
Well, that's a really interesting story, and I'm interested in those sort of land back sort of movements. A lot of the land in northern Wisconsin in northern Michigan, the UP, is ceded when there really isn't demand for it. There's maybe some demand for mining, some demand for timbering, but a lot of that land has then passed into sometimes public trust for counties or universities or other things. Sometimes it's passed into it was privately owned, but now it's owned. It's public land, and that restoring that kind of land, that's really fascinating to hear that kind of history. I've been interested in that. I think it's also quite interesting that a lot of the land that comes out of these treaties that I mentioned makes its way into the financial instruments that are used to create the land grant colleges in the United States, the Morrill Act, which creates which mandated the creation of a land grant university in all the states in the union, which is a university that focuses on agricultural training. Those universities are all funded through the Morrill Act, which used basically land that had been ceded by the tribes in the United States that have been turned into financial instruments like a bond and then sold or given back to the states, and the states then cash those land scripts in order to fund the endowments for the land grant universities. Huge amounts of the territory that had been ceded in the 1837 treaty makes its way into the public domain that's then used for funding land-grant universities. So, I mean, it's part of the public infrastructure of the United States comes from this transfer of land. And I think reckoning with that and coming to grips with it and finding things like in Superior where you can maybe give the land back if it's possible is a really interesting sort of recognition of this colonial history and sort of undoing some of the legacies of it.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. Michael, I don't want to miss something in your book. It isn't all big picture stuff. You share real people and their stories. One amazing story was leaders from the St. Croix Band of Ojibwe journeying against the advice of federal officials to negotiate directly with President Millard Fillmore in 1852 with some consequences. Can you briefly share that story?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, it was one of my distant relatives was on that trip, and it was a moment where when the treaties had been signed in Wisconsin, one of the provisions that leaders were making was that we won't be removed. And they were saying this is, the era of removal. And they said, well, sign the treaties if you're going to force us, but we want to remain on our land. And so that treaty had been made in 1854. The U.S. government was making plans to go back and remove tribes from northern Wisconsin. And they got wind of it. Some leaders did, as you mentioned, and they sort of snuck off the reservation, made their way to Washington, D.C., and were able to secure an audience with the president and get his commitment to not remove them, to let them stay on their homelands. And so it's a kind of an amazing example of Ojibwe people fighting to remain in their homeland, taking whatever they could in order to preserve that homeland, the territory, that connection to that landscape. And in this case, the journey was kind of amazing. They got stopped in Detroit. The Indian agent let them go on. They ran out of money in New York. They actually staged a dinner in a New York hotel where they invited people to come in and dine with the Ojibwe chiefs from Lake Superior to fund the rest of the trip to make it to D.C. So it was quite an amazing escapade in the 19th century where Indians were sort of popular cultural figures, but they're also sort of real people fighting to maintain their homeland. And that's part of the story of why Native people in Wisconsin don't get removed. They fought and resisted to stay in their homeland. And I would put a final note, they brought with them letters from a lot of the towns in Wisconsin on the Superior shoreline who were telling federal government they wanted, in fact, Indians to stay because they also recognized this political economy of plunder that I was mentioning. And they said, Indians are good neighbors, and so we don't want them removed. So they traveled with letters from non-Native peoples in Wisconsin who were also asking, along with the Ojibwe, to not let them be removed to Indian territory. Pretty amazing story.
Time for one more caller. Nancy is with us in Winneconne. Nancy, hi.
Hi. Thank you. I was in Kalamazoo, Michigan a few months ago, and there are some historical markers around the city, and they indicated that I believe they were Potawatomi who lived in that area, and they were forced to go west. I don't remember exactly where they had to go, but I recall that they had to leave.
Nancy, thanks for the call. And Michael, do you want to see wider efforts to share the history that you recount in your book, whether it's that public sign or other venues?
Absolutely. I think people don't realize the extent to which the history, particularly the Midwest, is an indigenous history. And American history is really intertwined with indigenous history in a way that can't be separated. So thinking about that is really important. I think thinking about the way that our public lands get created or public universities get created off this kind of colonial relationship is super important. Helping people realize that there's a connection with Native people have to land that still exists today, that's historic, that precedes America is really important when people see tribes exercising treaty rights, those sorts of things. So I'm all for getting this sort of message, this history out.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
That's Michael Witkin, professor in the Department of History and the Center for Study of Ethnicity and Race at Columbia University. He's a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. He was with us today to share his latest book. It's called Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. That was named a Pulitzer Prize finalist this year. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, stream live at WPR.org or check out our extremely extensive archives there. You can also download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. You're listening to the Ideas Network.